This is the Total Football Podcast. I'm your host, Egan Hart.
And I'm Andrew Conway.
Let's get on with the show.
This fella Ronaldo is a cod.
Arsene Wenger's been in Japan for a year. He doesn't know anything about English football.
I have nothing to say. I'm so sorry, I have nothing to say.
It's the history of the Tottenham.
But this action is really incredible. Incredible.
If you don't know the answer to that question, then I think you are an ostrich.
The Africa Cup of Nations started on Sunday afternoon. Cameroon, the hosts, won the opening game against Burkina Faso. They came from behind courtesy of two penalties to win 2-1. Are we ready for a month of madness, Andrew?
Well, you know, January madness is here. I'm not sure if I am ready, Declan. It's just a bit much at this point in time to face a 24-team international tournament in a country that may not be right for having it, with a bunch of players who may not be fit, healthy, and who knows if they want to be there either.
I imagine they do. The players want to be there. I think that is one thing we should make clear, I think.
Yeah, it's just with the AFCON, oftentimes we see that players don't perform to their best. You know, you oftentimes have, this is the best team. And we have had a few aberrations to that. I know Ghana have won it Ivory Coast rather, have won it a couple of times when they're expected to win it. Egypt won it one time when they're expected to win it. And obviously Algeria went out and won it the last time and they were one of the favourites at the start of the tournament. But, you know, oftentimes we see Ghana, the big countries, so-called big footballing countries of Africa, underperforming the Ghanas of this world.
See, I don't think
Nigerias of this world.
I don't think that is strictly an AFCON thing, though, because we've seen the same happen in World Cups for African countries like that. That same Ivory Coast team showed up at the World Cup, and yeah, they had a couple of really difficult draws over the years, but they were extremely talented. And I think, you know, we probably look back at them now and wonder how they didn't get to a knockout round or a quarterfinal or maybe even a semifinal, because the talent was there. But it just never turned out right for them. So, you know, we've seen that at World Cups as well.
Yeah. No, definitely. It just feels sometimes... it's like... So I used to really enjoy the African Cup of Nations growing up. I thought it was a wonderful tournament. You saw some very different football with players you don't necessarily know. It kind of had the magic of old World Cups. So you were like, I don't know who this team is or who these players are, and I'll watch it for that. Or I don't know who this French professional footballer who's now turned into a swashbuckling, long-haired, grey-suited maverick that is now managing some random country in Africa. I don't know who he is, but he seems to be great. And, you know, evidently they go on in a big run and some random country would win the African Cup of Nations. I'm not sure how, like, I think it's just the build-up has kind of soured it for me, I suppose. That's probably what's speaking to my kind of... Because, like, thinking about it in my memory, I do enjoy the African Cup of Nations whenever it's on. It's just kind of like, should this even be happening? Is there worries about COVID, about spreading COVID from Europe to more places at risk in Cameroon specifically? And should there be a stoppage to this in some way? Or should it be, again, transferred to a different country the way it was 2 years ago? Or was it 2 years ago when it went to Egypt the first time? And like, should that happen again? And plus, right before we came on, I noticed that this is the second tournament it is, I think, but it's gone to 24 teams, which isn't nice for me because I just don't like the 24 team format.
Yeah, like I can definitely see that the argument that it might dilute the quality of the overall tournament, but given like there's something different about there being an international tournament on in January, that makes me just be like, I'll just stick it on and I'll watch it, whereas I am more invested in watching every game. Focusing on every game, and it's on in the summer. I don't even know. Like, I think if the Euros is on now, I'd feel the same. Like, that I just, stick it on.
24 teams are terrible, you know.
Yeah, so in that sense, you know, obviously, maybe it has diluted the quality of it. If some of these teams are quite bad, I'm not quite sure what it will be like. But, you know, at the same time, it's always good that they get this moment in the sunshine that these players do get out to represent their country, because I do think that if it was aligned, say, with when Copa America and the Euros are on, it would probably get kind of forgotten as well.
I think they can stand on its own two feet in some regards. Like, I think like African football, to be honest, in if you watch certain recent African Cup of Nations, there are some bad matches in there, but they tend to be fairly exciting, well-matched teams playing each other. I don't know how this 24 team aspect of it's going to affect things. Maybe it'll be a bit more pragmatic because you have some smaller nations in the tournament that wouldn't necessarily be the top level African countries that you'd expect to be, say, challenging for World Cup qualification. But you know, they're there on merit, I suppose. They had to qualify, so if they're there, they deserve to be there, and we'll see. I'm concerned the big teams won't turn up again. That's my, you know, as I said earlier, it's my main concern that we won't get the electrifying football from the top level teams. And it's, while not the worst thing in the world, it would be a bit of a disappointment with the tournament.
And the other thing as well is that when we look at the, you know, the World Cup is really the only other opportunity we get to really analyse and look at these African nations in an international football context. And, you know, they only get, what, 5 spots in a 32 competition. They normally get tough draws out of that then, and they historically don't end up going very far. We've never had a semi-finalist. We've only had a few quarter-finalists in the history of the World Cup. So it is good that we get a whole month now of a celebration of African football, a nice spotlight on it. And, you know, I think it'll just be something that we can, you know, pop back into in a couple of weeks and be like, oh, what is going on in AFCON? Is any big teams getting knocked out or whatever? It's just a nice little story that's kind of in the background as well while we go about our daily business. So I'm looking forward to that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, it is going to be very rewarding, I suppose, in that aspect of things. Like, if we could, you know, would you? I still don't really get the whole the weird, you know, what happened a few years ago when they started having them every 2 years. Why did that materialize?
I don't know. I mean, why does Copa America have a competition like every year?
Yeah, well, you know, I have a problem with them as well. Like, it's like you make these things a bit further apart and they mean more, you know, that kind of way about it. We'll see. I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we'll get some good football out of it and a bit of kind of distraction from the standard fare that's going on at the club scene.
Yeah, and speaking of the club scene, I suppose we should talk about the FA Cup weekend that was. You know, we only really had the one.
How wonderful it was.
We had a couple of big upsets, but I suppose the biggest one was surely Arsenal, the 13 times holders getting knocked out. Or are they 14 now? God, I hope it's 13.
There's something like that, yeah. But they have the most, don't they?
They've won it the most amount of times, 100%. So, you know, they've been knocked out in the third round by Nottingham Forest, who are the only side to ever knock Arsenal out of the third round, I believe. But they've done it multiple times now.
I think the Arsenal and Notts Forest, despite not being in the same division for 23 years, have played each other for the last 5 years. In cup competitions, they keep getting drawn in the League Cup or in the FA Cup, and you know that I think last time around Arsenal tonked Forest. I think that was at the Emirates, and this time around Arsenal were just appalling. Like, there is mitigating circumstances in there, but they just really didn't show up to the game. Showed very little in attacking, because you know Forest have been getting a lot of plaudits for this upset, for really showing it to them, for the young wingers, say, at Forest, and indeed their old, you know, he's not that old, but you know, grabbing up front, grabbing the goal, if you will, later on in the game, of showing up and doing what they have to do. But I thought, well, the Forest were there for the taking, and Arsenal didn't take them. Now, whether there's people in the squad suffering from COVID, and you know, obviously important midfielders are missing, the base of their whole midfield was out. They played an 18-year-old in central midfield who got absolutely swamped by bigger men, basically. They were playing a centre forward who's going to leave the club for free in a couple of months because the guy they were going to play got COVID right before the match. I think they lack leadership, and even early on in the match, Nuno Tavares, the young left-back Arsenal signed, who thus far has impressed, apart from one problem he had against Liverpool, where he kind of gave away the ball playing around with it and they conceded a goal from it, has been quite composed this season, and he was pulled off after about 25 minutes for tactical reasons, because I don't know, Mikel Arteta was screaming at him. It's back to the same old Arsenal. They have this habit, you know, whenever things are going well, or they, not even when they're going well, when things look to be improving, or when there's an opportunity to snatch, which this really was. They had their game called off against Liverpool on Thursday night, so they had an extra few days to prepare for this game. Arteta's back from having COVID, and you know they just played Man City and played very well against Man City and were very unfortunate to lose in the last minute as they did. And they show up and they don't show up. They're there in person but not in mind. The attacking players did what they tried to do. I think Bukayo Saka and to an extent Gabriel Martinelli at least tried to create things with the very limited passes they received, but nowhere else in the field did anyone really cover themselves in much glory. And they're out again for another year, and Notts Forest march on. And you know, for a club that had their worst start in a very long, long time, I think you're going back decades and decades to the start of their season that they had, they were on the foot of the table in the Championship, looked to be going into relegation form, and have recovered to the level where they're going to probably be safe in the Championship, and they've beaten one of the informed Premier League sides and advanced the round four of the FA Cup to play what could potentially be a very COVID/injury hit Leicester City and march on from there in a local derby.
Yeah, like to talk about Nottingham Forest, like you're right to touch on the fact that they started the season off just terribly. That was under Chris Hughton. He was sacked there very quickly and replaced by Steve Cooper, who was at Swansea City last season and got them to the playoff final. Before leaving out by mutual consent. So then he joined in September, and you know they've really got on a great run of form since then, and they're up to I think 9th now in the Championship, 8th or 9th, and they're not too far off the playoffs, and you know the Championship can be very volatile at the best of times, so you know they're definitely within a shout of getting a playoff place. Probably a bit too soon to talk about them as a potential promotion candidate. There's some definitely three stronger sides in the Championship right now, but yeah, it's definitely the sign of a club going in the right direction. They've got some exciting players coming through, some good players out on loan.
Hollywood star James Garner on loan from Manchester United.
Yeah.
Every time the commentator said it, I was like, James Garner is back from the dead. You know, the Notebook star or the Great Escape star, whatever we want to look at him.
But they've gone on a great run of form, and you know it's funny that their reward for knocking out a club like Arsenal is the holders then in Leicester. So yeah, they probably couldn't have asked for a tougher third and fourth round draw, really.
Well, like you said, Leicester are suffering a bit from COVID, and like it's a local derby. You know they're close enough to each other. They probably don't really like each other. And Leicester finally won that FA Cup that Notts Forest, have been chasing for decades since Brian Clough's era.
And really, it's the tale of the two great underdogs of English football. You know, we can call it that now, can we? I think enough time has passed on the Leicester league.
I think Notts Forest will say that Leicester have to win a Champions League for that to be true. But yeah,
maybe. But you know, definitely an unbelievable scalp. Like even though Arsenal have their ups and downs, they've been in really good form lately. They nearly beat Man City there last week. I know they were without players that played in that game, but you know they were definitely a club on the rise in the last month or so. So a really big result for them. Really galvanizing for everyone at the club as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It does show, if you to pivot back to Arsenal, it does show the depth or the drop in class between the first team that say played against City, or the mostly first team that played against City, and the rest of the team, because they're several players are out through injury and through COVID, and you basically lost the spine of the team, you lost the cohesion of the team. You had a couple of starters in there, but they were all at the top of the field. They couldn't really get anything together, and it kind of showed that like there's players at that club who were either, in the case of say Sambi Lokonga and Nuno Tavares, maybe a bit too, is green the right word for it, a bit too fresh, a bit too young to be taking on the leadership roles that they're expected to take on in a game like this when there's no big characters around them. And if you look elsewhere, the likes of perhaps Rob Holding and obviously Cedric Suarez are just kind of not really of the requisite level when they're left to be in charge of things. One interesting thing that was on Isaiah Kolasinac, who was supposed to be a doubt for the game to start with, came on for, I believe, Cedric late on in the game. So they brought on a left back for a right back, and that was the big attacking change, and it did absolutely nothing. Now, I don't know, is that a case of trying to get players in the shop window to try and sell them? Because, you know, he's out of there. But it was a very bizarre decision from Mikel Arteta, and it speaks to the concerns I have about him as a manager. And I've said before, even when times are going good, he seems to manage to do something to throw a spanner in the works and make it all look terrible again. And even though this was, you know, considering what's coming up for Arsenal and considering their goals and their targets for the season, it's not the worst thing in the world that could happen to them. It's still, it hurts, like, to, or what's it, it's a hard pill to swallow. Similar to the way they kind of capitulated against Manchester United and certainly Everton. It does feel a bad trend that just comes up whenever there is some kind of, you know, whenever the sun is on the horizon and the rain is starting to clear up, there's, so, you know, this is just another thunder bolt, lightning bolt that really just sets everything back again to the way it was. And yeah, that's, I think that it bodes poorly for the upcoming weeks as well, where Arsenal have to play, you know, we'll talk about their fixture this weekend, but also have to play Liverpool twice in the Carabao Cup.
Yes.
And like, I honestly think Liverpool, who went and beat, was it Shrewsbury, but they beat them so comfortably with their second, like, I think Liverpool's second string against a team of men in Shrewsbury really did show up that they have the skill and ability and guile to get through most with a few senior players peppered in. And I think they would absolutely hammer this, you know, youthful reserve Arsenal side.
Yeah, then in some off-field news, we've got Ed Woodward announcing his leaving date for Manchester United's vice executive chairman or whatever.
Best paid vice executive chairman in the UK.
Yeah, whatever made up role he had. CEO, I think, is kind of the shorthand role that he basically had at the club. He's leaving at the start of February. He's been there since Ferguson left in 2013. He kind of took over because David Gill also left at the time and he had the role before him. And he's presided over, you know, a pretty disastrous period for the club.
Yeah.
You know, off the pitch or on the pitch, off the pitch, you know, revenues have grown and all that, and he's taken all the credit for that, of course. But
engagement is up.
I do remain skeptical as to how big of a role he actually had in that as well, given the fact that, you know, it's still Manchester United. They're still a pretty big club. They still had quite a lot of fans there that they could exploit for monetization. Yeah. So I don't know.
Like linking Ed Woodward to the success of Manchester United is like linking the CEO of Mercedes to the success of the hubcap they make. You know, it's not. They don't even exist in the same dimension.
The way that I see it is, you know, it'd be like praising the Glazers for allowing Ferguson to just kind of do what he was doing and for him to keep winning, like the Champions League win in 2008, the few league, the, I think five league wins that he won since the Glazers took over. Like, you know, there's no reason to credit the Glazers for that, and it's for much the same reason. There's no reason to credit Woodward for the commercial kind of growth, because it's been a pretty linear growth. It's not like they exponentially blew up commercially.
No, and to be honest, Manchester United have done nothing. Like if you're talking about proactivity, like what have United done in recent years to set them apart from other clubs? Like in the past, what they did was win things. That's how they set themselves apart. They were the prime team in the UK. They challenged in Europe. They won several Champions Leagues in Ferguson's era, but they are always in European football. They are always like fighting near the end of campaigns, whether it be in the league, the cup, or in Europe. And they always had like fantastic players at the club. They always had some of the best players in the country, if not in the world. You're looking back at, you know, the class of 92 and Beckham and you know, Scholes and Giggs and. Then you look at York and Cole up front, Eric Cantona, Roy Keane, obviously, Peter Schmeichel. These are all characters. And then you broach into the new century and you had a whole new raft of players and Wayne Rooney at the forefront of them. Cristiano Ronaldo originally, Park Ji-sung, Ruud van Nistelrooy, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer obviously played his part in it, Gary Neville, Fabian Barthez. You know, these are players that were world-renowned. And now what have you had in the last 10 years? How many Manchester United players can you name that actually did what they were made famous for at Manchester United? Like, you could make an argument for David De Gea.
Yeah.
I don't think there's many others that really, like, okay, why are they famous? Why are they some of the best players in the world? Why have they? Oh, because they've won the league at Manchester United, because they've won something at Manchester United, because they've done something at Manchester United. None of that's happened under his reign. Ed Woodward. But sorry, I got sidetracked talking back about football. But around the commercial side of things, the only thing they seem to be able to credit him with is the, and I doubt it was his idea, was the, is subjugation the right word, but the kind of the monetization of every aspect of Manchester United. Now, in fairness to the Glazers, apparently this was something that they targeted from the outset of the club. when they took over back, whenever it was, 15, 16 years ago now, that when originally, remember Manchester United lost the Vodafone shirt sponsorship?
Yeah.
And the Glazers thought this was great news, not terrible news, because they thought, oh, we should be signing localized deals with different voice carriers, mobile phone carriers in different areas of the world so that we can maximize our revenues. So it is something that's existed from the ownership down. So I don't think you could even, if anything, you should give that credit to the Glazers. Like, I don't know, like, can you think of activation, as they call it in modern parlance, or social media engagement, or like Manchester United have trailed apart behind everybody else when it comes to that, and have done for many years. Like, they were ahead when it came to MUTV 20 years ago, but I don't think they've had a major innovation in that space since then. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't feel like they have.
And one of the interesting things that I picked up on recently, well, just yesterday, I was reading Simon Cooper's Barcelona book there. I've been reading it for the last while in bed or whatnot. And one of the things that he picked up on at the end of the book was how, you know, in the past, Barcelona tried to copy Manchester United, you know, when Manchester United were successful. In terms of commercial growth and how they could, you know, be as big as them, and they copied them in terms of, you know, even just club philosophy, in terms of how to make the club bigger and grander, and spreading the fan base outside of Catalan and making it, you know, the most popular club in China or South America or whatever. But now that Manchester United have kind of gone through this mediocre period of the last 10 years or whatever, Simon Cooper pointed out that Barcelona are once again trying to copy Manchester United because they're trying to figure out how to remain commercially relevant while on the pitch they're not doing so well, while they are having their own mediocre period. And like, that's such a damning statement of Ed Woodward's period. Like, he managed to make the club commercially successful while the club itself was being like incredibly mediocre. Like, that's not a good thing. That's not what you want to be remembered for at all. Like, no one remembers that fondly.
Yeah. And I think it's also, it's a false success as well, because it's like the last 10 to 15 years, and I suppose a hyper-focus in the last 10 years. Is that how long he's been there? 9 years? How long he's had the top job since David Gill stepped down? Like, that was a period where all revenues in this era of the industry, of this sector, exploded. They found new ways of charging. They found new ways of harvesting money from fans globally. Not just, you know, obviously the television money exploded to a level unknown to anybody else, but a lot of other revenues went up as a kind of accompanying them. And you know, there was new markets opened up to clubs. There was new areas marketing for everything to be sold to. So I think it's the classic thing we've talked about with Manchester United before specifically, but the kit man should be getting fourth place with this Manchester United squad. And in fairness, I think the kit man should be getting the amount of revenue that Ed Woodward is, you know, congratulated for getting as CEO.
And the other thing with Woodward as well is that, like, you know, the on-pitch stuff does need to be recognised as well, because like, he has been the mastermind behind you know, finishes such as coming seventh under David Moyes, coming fifth under Louis van Gaal, coming sixth under Jose Mourinho. Like, especially like with David Moyes, you can say, okay, he inherited Ferguson's squad. They didn't have that much time to bring in Moyes' own players, and Moyes was handpicked by Ferguson. But when it comes to Louis van Gaal and Jose Mourinho, those were Woodward's men. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was and Woodward's Ollie. Man. Yeah. So
and you know, to an extent, Rafa Ranić,
that's the legacy, like, he leaves behind. Yeah. is a bunch of teams that weren't particularly exciting to watch. The players were not performing at their absolute best. You know, they had that period there in Louis van Gaal where I think it was 10 home games in a row were 0-0 at halftime, and they were called boring Man United. Was chanted up by the home fans. you know, it was really like contract decisions such as giving Phil Jones, Eric Bailly, Marcus Rojo,
Juan Mata,
Sergio Romero,
Marouane Fellaini before they sold him.
Many mediocre players given long term contracts on huge pay packets.
Alexis Sanchez. I think they're still paying him, aren't they?
I'm not sure if they're still paying him, but they, you know, whatever, but they were million, paying like, him was obscene. Yeah. Even the signing of Cristiano Ronaldo, which was, 4 months ago? Like, we can all agree.
Destabilized the whole team, yeah.
At this point, has been a complete disaster for the club. You know, like, these are bad decisions. And not only are they horrible decisions, but they're mistakes that they're making over and over again. Because we look at Alexis Sanchez. At the time, it didn't seem like a very clever signing. He'd not been particularly impressive for Arsenal for the 6 months of the season that far. He'd looked a little leggy, looked a little tired. He'd had a lot of football in his body. It was no surprise, really, that he'd fallen off a cliff, and Man United bought into it hook, line, and sinker that he was actually as good as new. And then they did the exact same mistake with Ronaldo, like, a few years later. They went after Galactico signings and Angel Di Maria. They went after
Paul Pogba,
yeah, who's, you know, still at the club at the very least. They went after young talent that just they've not been able to extract the maximum out of it. And Anthony Martial.
Yeah, Memphis I feel Dubai. Bad for Martial. Like,
yeah, these are players that had very young, promising careers and even, you know, had good starts.
Been ruined, yeah.
They had good starts at Man United. Like, Martial was a proper talent that first season, and even maybe second or third season he was doing quite well. But now he just looks like a shadow of his former self, being left with, you know, substandard coaching. You know, coaching facilities there, I guess you'd say, in the staff that were available to him. They're not they've never been able to maximize their resources, and given the amount that they have, like, that's just a total failure.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of talk you can do on this. I just think, like, the Manchester United team, the way that Liverpool were in the 90s and early 2000s, the Manchester United pundits have kind of taken over. Like, there's representation of the great Manchester United sides now in almost every studio out there, and a lot of newspapers as well, and other media coverage. And they have, while not giving them an easy ride, a kind of, you kind of get a bit more leeway, or you get a bit more attention towards the positives than you do towards the negatives. And even in that, they've kind of wasted away. They haven't taken full advantage of that kind of presence of you know, using this time where you have an easy ride to kind of do your learning, come out the other end of it. Like, I think
But they even ruined that, though, because Ed Woodward was the mastermind behind the European Super League from an English perspective.
Met with Boris Johnson, allegedly. Yeah.
Allegedly.
At Westminster.
Allegedly. Yeah. But, you know, like, he was the face of that guy, and that completely, like, soured all those pundits on everything to do with the ownership. Like, that was the first real sign we had of Gary Neville coming out on Monday Night Football, which was extraordinary. Like, he came out and admitted that he's been meek on that. He's not been strong enough on attacking the Glazers and their ownership. And he cited Ed Woodward as being a failure at the club. He cited the Glazers as being like a parasite on the club. And like, none of that would have happened if they hadn't signed up for the Super League stuff. He would have continued to have gotten a free ride to make terrible decisions. You know, like, even appointing Ole Gunnar Solskjaer kind of pointed at the mirror back at him, because, you know, Gary Neville's not going to have a go at Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, which we learned pretty quickly there. So, like, that was...
I didn't want Ron Atkinson to leave.
Yeah, like, that was an own goal there as well. And ultimately, you know, that's what's cost him this job, because I don't think if that Super League fiasco happens, he leaves, even though, you know, he's suggested he was planning to go anyway. I don't believe that at all.
Yeah, I think he fell on the sword for that one. And we'll see how much he does actually leave and if he returns in the consultancy role. But I was just like, even if you want to look at it from the pure footballing side of it, there is no coherent plan. Like, we've discussed many signings they've had in the past few years. But then several years ago, at the point of when they were getting rid of Jose Mourinho, there was discussion even before Mourinho went. And I've talked to you about this, and we've talked about it on the podcast before. They needed a technical director. They needed a way to go, a path to be written, someone to be in charge of transfers, a committee, a scouting department, a data analytics team, which was only appointed in recent times as well. Like, they're behind other clubs in terms of a lot of their processes and systems. And like, you're running a gigantic organization. I'm not even going to talk about the women's team and what happened with there. But like, there's a lot of things that lay at his door that they didn't do. And they actually, he is very savvy in some regards, but it does remind you of a kind of parasitical relationship, the way he uses the media to get messages out there. Like, we saw in this last week how he gave multiple interviews to trusted sources at different newspapers and different publications about, you know, to try and, you know, make him out to be not an anti-hero, but, you know, kind of a low grade hero. You know, he did what he had to do in the time that he was there, and he hopes people will remember, you know, he laid the groundwork or the framework for things to happen in the future. But I think that's absolute nonsense. And I think that is agency journalism. Is that the right term for it? Where you're kind of just, you know, you're giving them a story because, you know, you get future stories. So you're planting something easy, and it's, you know, a softball type of profile piece on them. like, I think that's terrible. Like, I think that the fact that he was able to do that on multiple occasions and say he was going to affect change and do something different and apply a plan and then didn't bother doing it and he wasn't picked out on it, I think that was a very annoying thing that happened time and time again. I hope it's not something that's going to be forgotten about, that he said he'd appoint a director of football. He said he would do this and do that several years ago, and it took years to happen when other clubs went through the same process and enacted the same process and actually went through like a whole system of like appointing, like, look, like, not that it went better for them or anything, but it did go better for some clubs. Like, you're looking at Leicester City doing a very similar change in that same period of time, Leeds United doing even in less time doing a very similar change with Bielsa and all the other side people brought into the club. Arsenal did something similar since they got rid of Arsene Wenger. You know, these are big clubs who had a very established way of doing things with vested interests, with similar ownership, and they're able to come out the other end of it, at least with a, you know, a working framework in intact behind it. Like, what does Ed Woodward leave Manchester United with, apart from a healthy balance sheet, which is what he inherited? He's not run the club into the ground, fair play to you. But I don't, like, again, the kit man wouldn't have run the club into the ground.
Yeah, it's a bit like, what do you want, a cookie? You know, for what he did.
Yeah, like, that's all he's done. Like, he's managed not to bankrupt the club. Despite spending ludicrous amounts of money on players that haven't worked out.
Like, and the debt has increased. Yeah. The Glazers have continued to take out their dividends every year. Like, you know, as we said, like,
the stadium looks crap. Not crap, but, you know, it needs work.
Oh, yeah.
The fans getting rained on through holes in the roof. The fact that the infrastructure was great in 1996.
But I know they did
the improvement up to 70,000 whenever they did that in like 2000 and something, 2005, 2006. But since then, they've done very little to restore prestige in the ground, in the surrounding area. And you only have to look at what Manchester City have done. And, you know, whatever you want to say about Manchester City, they have looked after the city compound. You know, the area around that, the space where the Etihad Stadium is, has been looked after to a certain extent. And they have put local amenities in place and worked with the council to do that. And I don't think they've done that with Old Trafford. And, you know, part of that is the absenteeism of the Glazers as the owners. But that's what they empower Glazer to do and the other executives to do. And they have no interest in it.
Yeah. And like, the other thing that stands out as well, like, we talk about that kind of the way that he did a bunch of profiles last week, like, this is not something new. You know, he hasn't come out all of a sudden and had all these quotes come out of nowhere. Like, this has been a constant over the last seven or eight years, trying to make himself look good. Like, he hired Neil Custis, was it, from The Sun as a PR consultant?
Yeah, used to present the Sunday supplement, didn't he?
Yeah, like, that was, you know, that was another thing that came out very quickly as well about it. I mean, a lot of leaks around Ed Woodward over the eight or nine years. But the other thing that always came out is he'd always have these earnest and sincere stories of how he was getting hands-on involved. And at the end of it, you'd always just be like, but that story doesn't make any sense. It makes you sound like a moron. It sounds like you don't have a clue what you're doing. Like, him saying that Mason Green was the most natural player at Manchester United. Like, what does that even mean? Him going around saying, if Manchester United is 100%, how much of that percentage does the manager do? And getting, like, a whole range of different answers. Like, obviously you got a whole range of different answers, because but every club has worked differently. Like, it's just so many things that were, like, comes down to having just basic knowledge of the game that he just didn't have, and he was in charge of a club the size of Manchester United, and he did not decide to delegate at any point. At no point did he say, actually, I'm not too sure of the answer to this, I'm going to go and hire X to do it for me instead, or I'm going to get Y to do it for me instead, or I'm going to hand it over to Z. It's such gross incompetence and arrogance to think that, oh, sure, I'll learn on the job, and sure, in a couple of years' time, I'll be flying it. Like, he basically tried to replace Ferguson himself, which is just such nonsense. Like,
and I think he probably thought that was his role, that it was to be the Ferguson-like figure, and that whoever he appointed would be under him, and he would be the main man. Like, there's a paper trail for this. You know, you're talking about bad decisions, but, like, you just have to look at the transfer business and how it went about. That you know, one summer he'd sign all the players from Mino Raiola, another summer from Jorge Mendes or George Mendes, another time, you know, some bunch of Dutch players. You know, it clearly was working as an agency transaction basis, you know, doing friends for the boys or tasks for the boys. And then you look at his successor, in, you know his name, the
Richard Arnold, and Richard Arnold,
Richard
is
Arnold,
actually,
who's just his friend who works at KPMG as well, and came up together, and it's like that's not a clear, that doesn't show me a transparent and clear appointment process for bringing in a new chief executive for a publicly listed company, which Manchester United, I believe, are. With the Glazers, like they should be a bit more transparent and all that, I think, and the fact that, as the Super League showed last year, that these aren't just companies to be bought and sold, they are a community for now anyway. They're still officially PLCs or whatever their official legal status is, but they are community strongholds. They are part of communities in Manchester, in England, in the world really, and have a higher purpose than necessarily these owners may care for them, and therefore this chief executive should have you know, subject to more stringent controls. Like, where is the fit and proper persons test for Richard Arnold? Where is his, you know, where is his qualifications for running a football club?
Yeah,
I don't know if he has some, or he might be great. I don't know. I don't want to judge the guy in advance, but just on paper, looking at it, looking at his CV, looking at his connections, looking at the conflicts of interest that exist with his appointing committee, you'd worry about it a bit.
No, I definitely agree with where you're coming from on that, and you know, the to play the devil's advocate, I suppose, is though you look at Ed Woodward and you wonder how much worse can someone do the job, really, and he's been able to, I know someone could do the job worse than Woodward, but realistically speaking, how much worse could someone who actually gets the job do worse than Woodward?
Well, they could run the club into the ground. They could do a Peter Ridsdale.
They could, but I
Ken Bates ran Chelsea very well for a long time, and at the same time ran it into the ground.
I think the likelihood of that is slim, you know, just because I don't think Man United will go around throwing around their money, just because that's the way the Glazers run the show. And I suppose that's really what happened with those clubs, is they threw around money they didn't have. But the thing as well with Richard Arnold is, like, really all it takes is someone like Richard Arnold to say, actually, I don't really know what I'm doing when it comes to the football side
signing
of things.
Signing players, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's really that simple of him just going, well, you know, this isn't really my area of expertise, because, you know, as CEO, my job isn't to do literally every part of this club. It's to delegate and find the best people to do each task. You know, that's really his role. And do it so that it sustains a growth period for the club, both on and off the pitch. And, you know, early indications are that he has recognized that he doesn't know anything about football, because, again, as one of Ed Woodward's mates, like, it's not shocking to hear he doesn't know a whole lot about football, even though he has spent time with the club. And I'm sure he's picked up the odd thing, but it does sound like he is, you know, delegating at the very least, which I think is a start. Again, I'm not saying he's going to come in and change the world. I mean, not going to become a powerhouse again all of a sudden, but I do think, you know, for better or for worse, it's a good thing that Ed Woodward is gone and someone else is in there instead.
Yeah, it's true. Although I do believe solemnly there's something to be said for the lottery system of just picking random people to be, you know, as they, I think the ancient Greeks did this, that, like, they just picked a random member of the population and they'd be the consul or whatever the equivalent would be. And yeah, maybe they should do that at Manchester United and make, like, I don't know, who's knocking around Dennis Irwin, make him chairman for a while, or maybe, you know, Phil Jones, this week you're chairman, and that's how it works. I don't think it'll result in much different performance financially. Yeah.
You know, in other business news in football, Southampton changed ownership this week with Gao Zhisheng selling his 80% stake for about £100 million to a group called Sport Republic, who are owned by a Serbian fellow. And the important thing to note here is that the club is essentially now being put in charge of, or it's now being run by Rasmus Ankersen, who is kind of the guy credited with building Brentford into a Premier League club. He left there in 2021. At some point, he was kind of he was known as the guy who spearheaded the destruction of the youth academy at Brentford, which is actually, you know, that sounds bad when you say it like that, but it's been quite successful for Brentford to, instead of a B team that they kind of go around and tour the world playing games, is my impression of what they do.
Yeah, so, like, I don't necessarily go on. I was just going to comment on the youth setup thing at Brentford. It makes perfect sense because they're in catchments of very popular clubs. Like, basically, Brentford were losing money on their youth system. They were developing these young players who would then at 13, 14 say, screw this, I'm going to play for Chelsea or Arsenal, West Ham, or somebody else in the London vicinity that might have a bigger name than Brentford or better facilities or whatever else like that. And Brentford are sick of it and say, okay, why do we even bother? All these kids are going to go to the nearby bigger clubs anyway, so let's just harvest at a kind of youth level or senior youth level. So let's harvest at like kind of an 18, 19 year old under 23 level and just have that as our backup team.
Mm.
At Southampton, it's going to be a bit different because they're the big fish in that area.
Yeah, I'm not bringing up the abolition of the Brentford's academy to say he's going to definitely do the same thing at Southampton.
No, yeah. The point, it made sense at Brentford. Like,
exactly.
In fairness,
it did. It made a lot of sense to do it at Brentford, and it's been quite successful for the club. I don't think the fans have thrown up any kind of fuss about it either.
No.
So, you know, he's kept everyone on side there, and it's, you know, been a growth area for them as well. So it shows that, you know, he's a guy who thinks outside the box, because, you know, I don't know what another club have thought of that at all. You know, I'm sure there's other clubs in London who might be thinking, well, you know, we're kind of in the same boat, we might do the same. So that's going to be interesting.
I think there is other clubs that are. One of the Sheffield clubs do it more recently. I remember it being referenced at the start of the season when they were talking about that with Brentford, that there is another club that was doing it.
It shows the creative thinking that he's brought in. Yeah. And obviously, we've seen the rise of Brentford over the few years, the kind of data-driven and analytics kind of model that they've used over the last few years. It's helped them go from being kind of a random EFL club that you'd never hear about unless they got a big cup draw to. Yeah. You know, they're in the Premier League now. They get big results. They got a draw against Liverpool, they beat Arsenal, you know, they're picking up really good results. They'll probably stay up this
season.
They're
hanging in there, yeah.
So, you know, in that sense, it's going to be a really interesting time for Southampton, because, you know, over the last few years now, I think Zhisheng bought the club in 2017, and they've kind of stagnated since then. Like, they've never really recaptured the period where they were selling all their players to Liverpool, where they're being managed by Pochettino and Coleman and qualifying for Europe. You know, they really did stagnate. They almost went down a couple of times. They just about stayed up the last few years.
Yeah.
Hasenhüttl
has masterminded the 9-0 defeat.
Yeah, Hasenhüttl, you know, 9-0 aside, I think has done a decent job there, especially given the constraints around his position there, because they just haven't spent any money. You know, Zhisheng didn't put any into the club. To his credit, he didn't take any out either. So he was a very passive owner. And I think having a more hands-on approach is probably, you know, it's good news for Southampton. It could all backfire. They could be in League One in a couple of years because they made a bunch of wrong decisions. But I think right now, this is probably a positive move for Southampton. I think that the expertise that they've brought in is probably a good sign. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they can do with the club.
Hopefully it is. The only prediction I'll make based on this, like, there is a worry whenever a club changes hands and it isn't by, like, you're not bought by the Saudi wealth fund or by an oligarch. You know, it's always a bit of a concern to what's going to happen to my club. Is my club going to be the new Nottingham Forest or the new Oldham or the new whoever else has suffered under ownership at different times in recent years, or Portsmouth for that matter, in a nearby club to Southampton? But it's my main prediction that this is Ralph Hasenhüttl is going to lose his job, because I don't know if I'm not sure if you can get a more passive owner than what they had and could endure that kind of defeat. If there is a hands-on type of aspect to this, like, he wasn't afraid of changing managers at Brentford, and I don't see that there's going to be a fear of changing managers at Southampton either. And if Hasenhüttl doesn't get on board with the way things are done, the way that... do you remember that guy that used to manage Brentford and went to Rangers? Used to be a stockbroker or something. I forget his name now. I think he was at Sunderland as well for a while afterwards. But like he was doing very well at Brentford. I think they got to the playoffs with him. And he was like, well, they're changing how we do things now, and they're going to be more data-centric, and so I'm off. I'm not going to stand around and be dictated to by data people, and good luck to them. And they got rid of him. And whoever they brought in afterwards did well. And I don't know, was it Thomas Frank they brought in afterwards? But that certainly is a... You know, they're not afraid of doing that. So I think Hasenhüttl's number on the wall, really, it's a matter of time before they get rid of him.
Yeah, like, I will say that Hasenhüttl, I think, will be very receptive to, you know, this new approach coming from the Orbi or the Red Bull kind of model of the way things were run there. And especially because the other thing that came out about this is that Sport Republic might be looking at setting up a network of their own, so buying Southampton might not be the only thing they do over the next few years. So, you know, Hasenhüttl has got experience working in that kind of model, so that might play to him as well. That might go in his favor. So I wouldn't say they'll throw him out immediately. I'm sure they'll
Will it be like a Watford type of situation? Yeah. You just keep pointing them every couple of months.
I do imagine they'll probably give him some time and assess the whole situation. Probably do a whole nitty gritty kind of filing system on how everything works at the club, and then maybe at the end of the decision make or at the end of the season make their decision. Unless something catastrophic happens, but it'll be interesting to see what they do with Osnoodle, because you know, change of ownership is one of the more obvious times to change manager as well.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to watch.
And then finally, in this long news segment, we've got a pretty exciting match.
It was FA Cup weekend.
You know, we spent none of it talking about the FA Cup. We will go back to some on-pitch action with the Juventus Roma match. Yeah, Serie A came back on Thursday, I think it was, and each team has played twice since then. Juve played against Roma on Sunday evening. And it was just an absolutely bonkers game of football. Remember how good that can be? Roma went 1-0 up in that game, and then Juve equalised. Then Roma went 3-1 up. But then, in the space of 7 minutes in the second half, Juve went 4-3 ahead. Then De Ligt got sent off and conceded a penalty, and Szczesny saved the penalty, and it finished 4-3. So Juve get the scalp there in the battle for fifth in Serie A. Juve, they're going to want to be pushing for some big wins. Like, they really needed that one because, you know, they're not dead certs to get top four at the moment.
No. I thought some of the most interesting things about this match was the fact that Roma really failed to create anything outside of set plays or set pieces. And, you know, most of their, I think all of the goals and the missed penalty were all set pieces, obviously. Juventus, they're dipping into the team a bit more. And that was a bit surprising for me. Like, they're trying different things. I still don't think they're up to much, and I still think there is a clear outcoming in that team. Matthias De Ligt getting sent off, I thought, was very harsh, but again, while not necessarily having as bad a time as Frankie De Jong has had at Barcelona, I don't know necessarily has De Ligt done it at Juventus. Saying that, he is still extremely young, especially for a centre half, so it's all recoverable, and the time is getting better for him. But yeah, Juventus are a funny little club at the moment. And Roma are even... How long does Mourinho last, to be honest? Like, he's had in different times to this point. He started well and then immediately started drifting off again. And when a Mourinho side is losing from a 3-1 up position, you know you're kind of in trouble. And a lot of the Juventus goals were very... They weren't even like coordinated attacks. Like, one of them was like a chip over a player, and he just kind of walked into the box and had a shot. Or Klineski, I think, finished it after a block shot. Like, it was just bizarre. And I think relying on set plays and your kind of big players to kind of chip one in the way that Pellegrino, is that how you say his name?
Pellegrini.
The Roma captain. Yeah. Pellegrini, the Roma captain. You know, he scored. What I thought Szczęsny could have done better in that free kick, but like, obviously the penalty was awful and the rebound was even worse, because the rebound was very... Szczęsny saved the penalty and kind of knocked it straight back to Pellegrini, and he just missed it, and he also knocked it away from Tammy Abraham, who was coming in running behind him. So like, double whammy of just like ruining that player's confidence now. And I'm sure Mourinho, I haven't actually followed the post-match thing, but I'm sure Mourinho blamed the players.
Yeah, like there was... Like, it was just so typical of both managers, I suppose, that because, you know, 1-1, I think Juve were kind of happy enough with that result, and they sat back, and then Roma punished them. And Juventus were awful on set pieces. Like, I know you mentioned that was kind of Roma's only avenue of attack, but it felt like every set piece they could have scored, you know, Juve were just diabolical. And eventually, like, Chris Smalling, I think, had a free header every corner that Roma had.
Yeah, they were... Like, for as much as Roma focused on them, Juventus were bad at them.
It was really poor, really lax. But then a 3-1, Roma just sat back and invited more and more pressure on, and it was inevitable that Juve would get one back, and then that kind of spurred them on to keep pushing even harder, and then the other two goals followed very simply. Like the Schilio being able to run into the box and
his first goal in 5 years.
Yeah, like, he scored a goal like, you know, you would have mistaken him for a high quality winger the way he was running into the box. And
No, I thought he looked like a right back on the finish, like, to be honest.
On the finish,
but very uncertain, and he kind of just kind of passed it into the corner.
The defending was just absolutely nowhere. Rui Patricio as well didn't cover himself in glory in goals either. Yeah, kind of a disaster for Roma, who I don't see qualifying for the top four at all. Like, it's a really tight title race there.
And the money they've spent, like, in COVID times.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. And like they're spending money in a really interesting way, like bringing Tammy Abraham and Ainsley Maitland-Niles, like that's really interesting for a club like Roma to do. And but yeah, it's just not working out at the moment, and I don't think that Mourinho will be there in 12 months time, we'll say, if I'll be generous. In terms of Juve, like, you know, Inter won there as well against Lazio later on Sunday night, so you know, Inter very much the favourites to win Serie A again, which I think would be quite impressive given the summer that they had, losing some of their best players and losing Antonio Conte.
Lukaku can still come back, you know.
Yeah, you know, if they magic up money out of nowhere, maybe. Then you've got the likes of Milan, Napoli, Atalanta, who've all at times looked magnificent this season, far better than Juventus, but they've all lacked that bit of consistency. They all have had little problems, you know, whether it's stuff going on in the back room with management and players falling out, or whether it's just a lack of form, or whether it is just injuries. Like Napoli have been absolutely ravaged by injuries in a really unfortunate way that really kind of hampered.
Told you this was going to happen.
I still think that if they can get everyone fit and ready for the second half of the season, they could come back at Inter because they're still close enough. But yeah, they've been quite unlucky, and that I think does open the door for Juve to sneak in, like they did last season, basically. But they need to find a bit more consistency themselves as well, because they're kind of grinding out crappy wins here and there. They don't look convincing at all. And I think, you know, given the Super League fiasco, I think we'd all find it quite funny if they didn't make top four. But you know, there you can never count out Juventus, this game included.
Yeah, like I'd make a prediction in Serie A, not knowing a great deal about it, that Napoli won't finish second.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Yeah, so you can take of what you want from that, but guess which way I'm leaning towards.
I love football. Thank you.
Newcastle United lost at home to Cambridge United this weekend, a humiliating exit from the FA Cup. However, they did sign Kieran Trippier from Atletico Madrid for around £12 million. Philip Coutinho also returned to the Premier League by signing for Aston Villa on loan on a loan deal for the rest of the season. Are we set for a busy January, or will this be as exciting as it gets?
Well, what was West Ham? David Moyes saying that he would prefer if the winter window was banned. You know, this is the guy that Sam Maran Fellaini on Juan Mata in a helicopter had a winter window. And also that the players who were signed in the winter window shouldn't be allowed to play any rearranged matches from the first half of the season. I think there will be a busy enough period happening. I think there's new managers at certain clubs. You're looking at Spurs, you're looking at Manchester United, that are in the market. I think Arsenal are in the market for players, given that they've, you know, basically ostracised and kicked off their captain and star striker, that they have to make signings. And I think the Nottingham Forest match also points to the fact that they're very weak in depth, so they need to actually, you know, stiffen things up around the squad. I also think the likes of Liverpool, I think this will be busier than most other windows we've had in recent times, especially winter windows, because I think there's a lot of clubs that have clear gaps that aren't being helped by externalities like COVID or injuries or the AFCON going on or fixture congestion, that they need to fill out the squad and bring in more experience, bring in more depth. And I think, like, especially you're looking at even the top end of the league, I think Manchester City could benefit with the signing. Just to kind of, you know, they are my favourites for the league, and they're going to be one of the favourites for the Champions League. But I think another player up front for them could really see them, you know, reach another level. Especially if it's someone of immense quality. You know, they were looking for Harry Kane all summer. They thought they had him at one stage, and they didn't. There's talks that they might be able to get Haaland in the summer. Who knows? But I think a player of that caliber coming to City in the middle of the year could be very enticing to a club with limitless resources. And then further down the league, I think you're going to see Newcastle United go hell for leather on it. I thought and predicted inaccurately that they would maybe try and focus on the cup, and I think in fairness they did, given the team they put out and given the style of football they played against Cambridge. They were going for this match. They didn't lose through lack of trying. but they just were not good enough. And I think that really did sing home to, I believe, the owner, or the representative of the owner, going and going down to the dressing room when Eddie Howe wasn't there with his bodyguards in tow, to have a few words with the players. I think that shows the graveness of the situation at Newcastle and how they have to perform. And I think a lot of players will be leaving the club, maybe not in the winter window, but certainly in the summer. And I think that'll pave the way for a lot of signings. And I wouldn't be surprised if we get similar enough to Felipe Coutinho-esque signings at Newcastle in the window. I know Aaron Ramsey's been linked there. I know there's been other players of similar ilk that may be out of favour at different clubs around the place that, you know, maybe could have some kind of impact at Newcastle. I still don't think it'll be good enough to get them out of the relegation zone. I feel they're too disjointed at the moment and don't have a spine there to work on yet. And I'm not sure if Eddie Howe is the man to take them that way. But yeah, I think it's going to be a busy period. I think there's a lot of gaps to fill in clubs that have taken it easy in recent windows, if you will, especially at the top end of the league.
Yeah, like Newcastle are the ones with the massive spotlight on them at the moment, especially considering the loss to Cambridge United the weekend at home in front of a full or almost full stadium. Like, that's just completely embarrassing for everyone involved.
Yeah.
You know, that was Kieran Trippier's debut.
The keeper, what was his name? The Cambridge United keeper did have an amazing match.
but even then, like, this is a Premier League club going up against a side in what, League Two? Are they even in League Two? You know, like, it's a terrible look considering they're about to probably splash about 100, 150 million more on the transfer market.
Sam Maximan was there. Joel Linton was there. Kieran Trippier, as you said, was there. Like, these are top level.
Yeah, and that's what makes it. That's what makes it embarrassing. Like, they managed to lose. You know, despite their resources. And you know, I don't really think it says much about Eddie Howe. I think he's realized the difficulty of the job over the last few weeks, and he started to try to wonder how he even configures his team together, and that's why they've been struggling to get any kind of results.
No Brucey bonus.
Yeah, like I wonder. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see who they get linked with. Like, I wonder will they get linked with the likes of Chris Smalling and stuff. You know, older English players, like more in the lines of, like, he'd be another Kieran Trippier type, an older English player coming back for one last run in England at a decent level.
One last time.
Yeah, one last job. The way I saw it put as well is that Newcastle basically have to have the equivalent of Aston Villa season condensed into the rest of the second half of the season to have a 50% chance of staying up, which is not very good odds for a difficult task, which really makes it sound like it's going to be incredibly difficult for them to stay up, especially when you look at who is in the team at the moment. Like, we don't know who they're going to get in. It's so scattershot as well, the type of players that they're being linked to, that it seems impossible that they all gel immediately. Like, it's hard to tell, are these people that Eddie Howe, like, did Eddie Howe want Kieran Trippier, or did Eddie Howe just get Kieran Trippier foisted
was given,
upon him?
Yeah, I'd say he was given him. Like, that's going to be the way. Yeah, like the talk, and I don't know, there was bias in these, but there was talk in the northeastern media in the UK about how, you know, there was no real footballing minds put behind this bid and takeover attempt at Newcastle United, and that Eddie Howe obviously wasn't the first choice. He was the final choice, but not the first choice.
Well, I hear a new CEO is available.
Because I think the Amanda Sievely and her partner are the you know, they're going to run the club from that point of view, from the executive point of view. But certainly they have brought people in, but I don't see a cohesive plan in place there, and I don't think there is a cohesive. They need a cheeky Berger sign, and what's the name of the other guy at Man City?
Soriano,
to kind of come in and be in charge of, let them handle the footballing side of things and appoint the correct manager and appoint the correct scouting teams and appoint the correct data analytics teams and look at the overhaul their youth system, overhaul their scouting system, overhaul their player identification and pursuit system, their academy. Like, this is like, it's not going to happen overnight. It took Man City the bones of a decade to really get it right. Chelsea, something similar to the level where they have 31 players out on loan now, which is, you know, too far the other way, if you will. But that's the steps that these clubs had to take when they got bought by who they got bought by, and they wanted to take the next step up to become you know, to join up the levels of Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, the clubs that were at the top of the game at the time. And that's, you know, it takes a bit of time to do that. And I think they're going through their teething problems. And unfortunately for Newcastle United, I think they're making mistakes now that other clubs already made. And maybe they could have looked to see that and avoided them and maybe brought in football people from day one. But I'd say they'll learn it, but they might have to face a relegation or two before they'll get there.
And that would be a disaster for Newcastle, considering, you know, this type of project. You know, we're going to have to compare it to Man City. Like, Man City got things sorted and were top four candidates within, you know, 2 or 3 years. Whereas, you know, will Newcastle even be back in the Premier League in 2 to 3 years if they get relegated? Like, because they have so much money, but they'll be the most expensively assembled Championship squad ever. Which, you know, in its own way will be its own disgrace if it happens.
I think Newcastle already hold that privilege from the last time they went down.
Probably. And then just the signing of Kieran Trippier as well, from an Atletico Madrid perspective, also seems quite strange. Like, it's mid-season. He's a pretty important player for them, and they've just kind of let him go for a relatively low fee. You know, I don't know, will they be able to even afford to bring in a replacement for him? Like, things aren't going particularly well for them this season in the league. Like, they might not finish in the top four the way some of their games go.
We'll
see how they do in the Champions League, but they were lucky to scrape through that group.
They oftentimes are, though. They were the seasons they got to the Champions League finals. They were poor in a lot of the group games. They were even poor in some of the knockout games, as we saw them against Juventus. Was that last year or the year before, where they were just appalling and playing for a draw?
They lost that game, though. They lost.
Oh, they did in the end, yeah. But sometimes they got through that, is what I'm saying. And they obviously did in the group as well. The thing with Atletico, and I take everything you said on board, and I don't know if you get this impression, but I think Simeone and the Atletico ownership and the decision makers over there, they do have this habit of, you know, I compare it to the way someone would cultivate a rose bush. You know how you have to cut off the flower to allow the bush to grow further and to grow better and the flowers to grow more? You prune it. And I do find they don't hesitate at that Atletico. They're like, okay, we've got an offer for this player. Let's do it. It might hurt in the medium term, short to medium term, but I think it's the right decision in the long term, and we'll grow to something else in this time. And I think that's the decision they've made with Trippier. It does seem weird. Considering he was a starter.
The thing I would say for that, though, is normally that's a case of a 45 million bid comes in from China for Martinez was the one that stands out. Like, that was a one where it's like, okay, well, we've got this really talented player, but we can't really say no to this offer. Whereas, like, I think they could have just said no to Trippier. Like, I'm sure Trippier obviously pushed for the move and wanted to go, because otherwise it wouldn't have happened. But still, it's such a low offer, and it seems like a lack of ambition as well from Trippier to go to Newcastle United when he could in theory win a Champions League if he stays at Atletico Madrid. If they, you know,
well, does he get a medal?
Philippe Coutinho, did he get a medal when Liverpool got to the semi-final that time? And it's all come full circle for him as well. He's back in the Premier League now with his mate Steven Gerrard in charge. This seems like another weird signing, especially in the context of what they did to replace Jack Grealish in the summer, where they were like, you know, we knew we couldn't replace him with one guy, so we tried to replace him with three, and that's not really 100% work. Like, Dean Smith lost his job over the whole thing, and they brought in Gerrard now, and he's doing an okay job turning it around so far. But Coutinho just seems like another Buendia or Leon Bailey type. Like, he'll just slot in there as well again. Like, would they play the three of them together with Ollie Watkins and Danny Ings? Like, that doesn't seem very balanced.
No, they
at
won't.
All.
No. That, like, I honestly see, the more I think about Coutinho at Villa, the more, one, it seems like an opportunistic. It's like, well, he's available. Gerrard knows him, brings him in. Coutinho's happy enough to go with a guy he knows. It's back in England where, you know, good memories are. It's not in Germany. It's not stuck on the bench rotting at Barcelona. At least he'll get to play a bit of football, and there won't be a huge expectation on him the way he would if he, you know, went to a big club for a big amount of money, which was the other alternative, I suppose, but no one is really putting up that money for him. But I honestly think that what he'll add to Aston Villa is just experience. Like, I don't expect him to be playing week in, week out, to be honest. He just hasn't been that player for the last few years for any club he's been at.
A bit like James, maybe, at Everton last season.
something like that, but I think in the differences with this Villa side, like you've mentioned those players, but the crucial thing about those players is they're young and they're inexperienced and they have a habit of kind of phoning it in or not showing up on occasion. And whatever we say about Philip Coutinho, he's won the Champions League, you know, he's won league titles. He is a guy that's been there and done that. He's been at, like, in his, he's only 29, but he's been at Inter, he's been at Liverpool, he's been at Barcelona, he's been at Bayern Munich. You know, he's Brazil, you know, the huge pressure that comes with being a Brazil international, especially in a team with Neymar there, where you challenge Neymar for a position, you know, that he's used to the pressure being on him. And I think he could bring that, I think, bit of aura, a bit of stability, a bit of, believability in that you could actually do something and win, because we've got that guy in our team. Like, I think that's almost a similar role to what Jack Grealish served last year. And I personally think Philip Coutinho is a better player through sheer talent than Jack Grealish, but he just doesn't apply himself as well as Grealish has. But I, like, he could be that guy and be that lightning rod for a kind of attention that Villa might need to kind of break away and play better football. At the very least, I think, like, what happens if it doesn't work out? You just write it, chalk it off to, like, oh, it's just Steven Gerrard's friend. It seemed like a good idea. It didn't work out. It probably didn't cost Villa a huge amount of money, so they move on.
Yeah, like, the reported figure, I believe, at the moment is that they're paying 35% of Aston Villa's wages, which also means that Barcelona haven't shed enough of their wage bill for them to be able to register Frank Torres, which is...
Yes, Frankie de Jong is going somewhere.
Which is just really funny when we get down to the basics. I'm heartily laughing at Barcelona's misery. But when it comes to Coutinho, like, I think he's the one that has the most to lose here. Like, you're right that Villa, you know, for 35% of his wages, it's not a huge amount. It's a six-month loan deal. You know, if he doesn't play, so be it. They've got other players there that are probably learning from him. But then you've got Coutinho, who's got everything to lose. Like, if he flops here, if he doesn't make it into the Aston Villa squad, like, he's finished, really, at the highest level. He's not going to...
Oh, yeah.
Like, would he go back to Brazil? He's going back to Brazil. Or to...
Well, like, it hasn't worked out in Spain. It didn't work out in Italy. And you thought, well, they're slower pace. They might work as... Like, his best spell was at Liverpool. Like, he had a few moments at Inter. But his best spell was definitely at Liverpool. And like, Liverpool were offered him and they didn't take him back, and considering the not necessarily the woes Liverpool are under, because I don't think they are in that position this season as much as they could be, but certainly they could use it a bit more strength and depth and especially experience, and they didn't want anything to do with him. So yeah, it might just be the end of the line for him.
History of the Tottenham. We believe in the history.
It's a big week for Premier League fixtures this weekend. We've got Man City hosting Chelsea on Saturday afternoon, and then the North London Derby at the White Hart Lane on Sunday. Which of these two games are you most looking forward to, Andrew?
I think the White Hart Lane Derby. The North London Derby, because as you've discussed many times before, and we've probably cursed it maybe, there is generally good games. Now, I think Antonio Conte will try and put a stop to that. In this, but Arsenal need to have a performance, given the aforementioned terrible result that we talked about in the previous parts of the show. They need to do something out of this, and I think they have the potential to really put Spurs to the sword if they perform to their best of their ability. Whether they can do that or not, I don't know. We might get another case of the Everton or Manchester United-esque performance rather than the Man City performance we saw just last week. Spurs on the other side, I think this is basically they would overtake Arsenal and be back into the... Depending on other results, they may not be in the top four, but they certainly would feel like they were the top four contender, the prime top four contender from the Tottenham, Manchester United and Arsenal contingent if they get this result, given the kind of up and down squad depth they've had in the last few weeks and the fixtures that they've faced. This will be a good result for the last month of football. So I think there's a lot riding on it, and I think there is a derby atmosphere to be expected. I think there'll be a lot on the line for it, and we'll see whether either side have new signings to show off during the game as well, which could add an extra dimension to things.
Yeah, like, I think this game is very nicely poised because both teams have kind of had a bit of a disaster going into it. You know, Tottenham had the hilarious own goal that they scored against Chelsea in the 2-0 loss at Stamford Bridge in the Carabao Cup. as we discussed, Arsenal getting knocked out of the FA Cup, and then, you know, Tottenham nearly followed suit. They just about scraped past, I forget who they were playing now, but it was lower league opposition that they needed a comeback win against at home.
Harry Winks.
Yeah, scoring opposite a free kick. So, that was a poor, poor couple of performances. Antonio Conte coming out with his remarks about how basically the squad isn't good enough. Which is ominous.
Normal stuff. That's the history of the Tottenham.
Yeah, he's like this close to actually saying those words, which would just be very funny to say the exact same phrase. The North London Derby we've talked about obviously in the past has been really exciting, even as managers have changed for both clubs. And the fact that both teams could be missing players, like Son is probably going to be out of this game for Tottenham. You know, we've discussed Arsenal's injury issues and absences as well at length. So, you know, that might open up this game a bit more. Like, I don't know, like Conte isn't that defensive of a coach. I do think he likes to go for it in these games. You know, we saw how exciting that game was against Liverpool. Like, they sat back and they tried
they
to counter,
didn't go
but
for
they,
it.
Yeah. But they were aggressive. They were aggressive with the ball and they looked for each other. They didn't just hoof it.
Yeah, and Arsenal don't have a midfield, which would be a very similar setup to the way Liverpool were playing that day. Because as it stands, I don't know if Granit Xhaka will be back for Sunday from COVID, because he did test positive for COVID, I think, yesterday. So I don't know what is the timeline now for coming back from COVID. Is it only 5 days or is it seven days?
I think it's 5 days. That's what
he'll be
here.
Without training anyway.
So
I'm sure he's training on his own, but he won't be, you know, working on the match beforehand. But he's the only senior midfielder I think that's available.
And that's assuming he like has a normal recovery. Like he could be still sick.
Yeah,
whatever,
he could absolutely. Ainsley Niles has gone to Roma. He was an option. You're like Charlie Patino is an 18-year-old played against Notts Forest. Who do you play in midfield? Sambi Lokonga plus one, and you don't know who that plus one is. You're going to be playing
Mo Elneny?
He's gone to AFCON.
Oh, of course,
Egypt.
Yes. Of course.
So there's nobody. There's literally nobody left. Like the option would be to play Odegaard deeper and hope Smith Rowe's back from injury, because he missed the match from injury. Yeah. And Tomiyasu is something similar. Like, he is someone that could cover it.
Where's Danny Ceballos?
He has played zero matches for Real Madrid this year.
Get him
I
in.
Did check on his status for the laugh to see, well, how is Danny Ceballos doing? Did he join, like, Levante? The way that, like, a lot of our ex-Arsenal players seem to have joined this season. But no, he's still at Real Madrid, apparently, not playing any football.
Yeah, whereas then the game on Saturday, like, these two teams have faced a lot of each other over the last, basically since Thomas Tuchel's come in. Yeah. Obviously, the FA Cup semi-final, the Champions League final, the league game that was around that. They've met in the league again since then. And I wouldn't say any of those games are particularly exciting. No. You know, I do want to look forward to this game, but I think the fact that it'll be on Saturday afternoon, like, we'll get it out of the way early, might be a good thing, you know, get it done with, because that's what happened last time when they faced the Stamford Bridge. We got a ton early. City got a pretty crappy 1-0 win with a scuff goal, and we all moved on and forgot about that game pretty quickly. And I think it could be a similar case here. Like, you know, I hope Chelsea just kind of go for it a bit more. Like, they don't have as much to lose now, because the title's kind of gone anyway. So they should really just go up Man City. And you know, we saw what Arsenal were capable of when they went at Man City last week. Like, that really is a template for how to play against this team right now. Because, like, you know, this time last year, Man City kind of, you know, they adapted the best to COVID, and that was kind of what was kind of Pep's crowning achievement for the year, was that they just struggled the life out of games, and that's why they were kind of called, they coined a struggle ball as a COVID reaction. And they've kind of been doing that. I think that, you know, when teams do, you know, they're very good at dragging teams down to that level where it's like, okay, we're going to play this game really slow and we're going to dictate the tempo. But I think if you can disrupt that a little bit, you can get at them. And, like, Chelsea have the capacity to disrupt the City team. They obviously have a ton of talent. We saw how entertaining the Liverpool game was there last week. Like, they definitely have the potential, but I just don't know, is Tuchel brave enough to do it against this City team?
My answer to that is probably no. I don't see him, he'll do it. I think if he does it, it'll be through sheer fluke that his players do. And I kind of felt that was the way against Liverpool, that an opportunity presented itself. They scored a goal out of absolutely nothing, like a worldie, as they did against Liverpool. And it just kind of, they took the momentum from there without much instruction from Tuchel. And I think that could happen again. Like you said, they absolutely have the talent on the field. Lukaku's back in there to act as a battering, not a battering ram is unfair to Lukaku, but I think that's, he'll be used as a lightning rod for attention for the City centre-backs, and I think they will not be happy with having to face Lukaku in that way, and that might give and free up more space for the supporting players and Mason Mounts, the Kai Havertz of this world, if you will, to work their like little intricate passing and try and create something for it. But I think it all depends on how well Chelsea's midfield can cope with the, like you said, the struggle ball, the City strangling the life out of the game through their you know, intense pressure in midfield and just containment of the ball, as they tend to do, and moving things from right to left to right to left to right to left until eventually they pull off a shot and usually score. I feel it has a City win written all over it, which, you know, doesn't really look good for Tuchel if you actually look at his recent record. Like, it's not been a good last month or so, with the exception of the Carabao Cup game. And the FA Cup indeed, but you know, the rest of it's not looking great, and you know, as we said, there's more interesting times coming for him, and yeah, we'll see whether he's at the beginning of the end, or the end, the beginning of the start of the end of the beginning, whatever the stage of his managerial career at Chelsea is.
Yeah, I'm kind of disappointed this game isn't the early kickoff on Sunday, just so we could get the wonderful contrast between these two games, yeah, and these four teams, because I do think they'll be wildly different in both quality and entertainment factor. So yeah, we'll have to note that as well next week when we analyze both games. But until then, I think that about does it for this week. So thank you for being here, Andrew.
And thank you for having me, Dale.
And we'll be back again next week. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then don't forget you can tell family and friends about the show. Spread the word of the Total Football Takeover. This show can also be found on podcast services including Spotify by searching Total Football Podcast. You can also subscribe to my own Medium page in the show notes. You can follow Andrew on Twitter at Conbon27, C-O-N-B-O-N, and myself at Cheesy Heartpun, C-H-E-E-S-Y-H-I-R-T-E-P-U-N. Most of all, thank you for listening, and we hope to be in your download feed next week too. The more the merrier. That's what we always say.